China urges the United States to abandon its, quote, bullying to rein in the Asian countries' development. Japan's inflation hit 3.7% in November, the highest since 1981, fueled by higher energy costs. Also ahead, a deep freeze coupled with a massive winter storm hits the U.S. Midwest, leaving two-thirds of the nation under extreme weather alerts. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, China has urged the United States to abandon its, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying to rein in the Asian country's development. During a phone call, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi told his U.S. counterpart Antony Blinken that Washington must pay attention to Beijing's legitimate concerns. Wang also warned the U.S. not to try to cross China's red lines, but expressed hope that the two sides can work together to promote dialogue in the future. Washington received a similar warning from Beijing about a month ago. During a summit in Bali, President Xi Jinping told his American counterpart to refrain from challenging Beijing's sovereignty over Taiwan. And China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and says the U.S. is stirring up separatist sentiments on the self-ruled island. Tensions remain high on the Korean Peninsula as North Korea test fires two more ballistic missiles off its coast. The South Korean military and Japanese Coast Guard said the missiles landed in the Sea of Japan. The new launches come days after the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un claimed Pyongyang had developed advanced technologies to take images from space using a spy satellite. The program is intended to be completed by April. Pyongyang has conducted a number of missile tests this year. That's in response to the United States' growing presence, military presence, in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Recently, the U.S. and its allies warned that Pyongyang is preparing to conduct its first nuclear test since 2017. Meanwhile, Japan's decision to boost its military spending has drawn strong rebukes from civic leaders in South Korea. Tokyo argues its move to build up its forces comes amid threats from North Korea and Japan and China. That is, Tokyo's arms purchases will also provide a boon for U.S. weapons producers. Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent
in America's military-industrial complex.
Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Japan is feeling the pinch, meanwhile, of the skyrocketing energy costs, as official data show prices of essential commodities rose at their fastest pace last month. According to data released by the Interior Ministry, core consumer prices climbed 3.7% in November compared to the previous year. The rise in prices for processed food items as well as electricity and durable goods has been the highest in the last four decades. The Japanese central bank, unlike Western economies, has not yet hiked interest rates to tackle soaring inflation, which have driven down the value of the yen against the dollar. The bank says it sees the recent price increases as temporary and that there is no reason to change course yet. The surge in food and energy prices around the globe has been largely attributed to the ongoing war in Ukraine and the West's standoff with Russia. And news of stock markets volatility. Asian shares have plunged after Wall Street witnessed losses fueled by expectations that the Federal Reserve will lift the benchmark lending rates well into next year. Tokyo stocks opened lower on Friday, with the Nikkei index shedding over 1%. Stocks in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Seoul slipped as well. The drops came on the heels of jittery in Wall Street, where three main indexes ended well in the red on Thursday. Investors in global markets were seen nervous over earnings fluctuations and credit risks this month. Meanwhile, the Bank of Japan has decided to move away from its ultra-loose monetary policy. Other major central banks are also likely to raise interest rates higher than expected. Moving to some breaking news reaching us over the last few hours, Israeli forces have shot dead yet another Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. They accused him of ramming his car into a group of soldiers in Kafr Qasim town, injuring two Israeli troops. For more on that, let's bring in Mona Kandil, our correspondent in the occupied Palestinian territories. Mona, what more can you tell us about this latest incident and the murder of another Palestinian by regime forces?
Well, this time the killing took place in the Palestinian village of Kfar Qasim. It's in the lands that were occupied in 1948. We're speaking about, of course, Israeli control there. What happened, according to the Israeli police story, is that this Palestinian man were, of course, the Israeli regime considered as Arab Israeli, not Palestinian. Naeem Abdir, 23-year-old, according to the Israeli police, he called the Israeli police and claimed that there is an urgent incident in his home, and then Israeli police officers were dispatched there. They claimed that he was in his vehicle and that he ran his vehicle into the police officers. Then he escaped. They chased him and he opened fire at them, according, of course, to the Israeli police story. He wounded two Israeli police officers, and he was shot dead at the there next to his home. The family denies the story. They say that the Israeli police story is mistaken and that they killed their son in cold blood. Following the incident, Israeli police arrested a number of Naeem Abdir family members and took them for interrogation. We have to mention that in Kfar Qasim, this Palestinian town, Palestinians, of course, do not receive their, let's say, their full rights like the the Jewish Israelis living in the lands that were occupied in 1948. From a time to another, we know about some incidents, clashes between the Palestinians who are still living in the lands occupied in 1948 and the Israeli police. And the Israelis, like the Jews, they are quick to pull the trigger here in the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds. It's the same thing being carried out in the lands occupied in 1948, of course.
Okay, Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kadil there with the latest, joining us live from the occupied Palestinian territories. Moving on, a deep freeze coupled with a massive winter storm hits the U.S. Midwest, leaving two-thirds of the nation under extreme weather alerts. The National Weather Service says the storm has affected more than 200 million people as the country is heading into the Christmas holiday weekend. Even President Joe Biden has described the condition as dangerous and threatening. The storm is forecast to develop into a, quote, bomb cyclone because of heavy snowfalls and chilling weather. Snow has blanketed areas stretching from the northern plains and Great Lakes to the upper Mississippi Valley and western New York. It is expected as far south as the U.S.-Mexico border. More than 5,000 flights scheduled for Thursday and Friday have also been cancelled, causing chaos among airbound travelers. Staying in the U.S., where a congressional panel probing the 2021 attack on the Capitol building has released its final report. It accuses former President Donald Trump of inciting the deadly riots and engaging in a conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election results. The 800-page report is based on more than 1,000 interviews and hundreds of thousands of documents, as well as federal and state court rulings. The report indicates the former president knew he had lost the election, but still pressured officials, as well as his deputy, against the vote outcome. He then directly summoned what the committee calls a violent mob and refused to ask his supporters to leave. The report is made public just days after the panel asked the Justice Department to charge Trump for four crimes, including obstruction and insurrection. It is the first time Congress has referred a former president to criminal prosecution in U.S. history. Trump dismisses the committee and its report as a political witch hunt. The Pakistani Taliban claim responsibility for a suicide blast in the capital, Islamabad, that left at least one police officer dead and several other people wounded. Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan said the attack was in retaliation for the recent killing of its senior member. Police say the driver of a suspicious taxi detonated an explosive device when officers tried to stop his vehicle. The driver was accompanied by a female whose fate remains unknown. The terrorist group has intensified its activities after calling off a ceasefire with the government in November. Earlier this week, Pakistan's defense minister called for a fresh anti-terror operation after the group seized a police station and took dozens of people hostage in the country's northwest. A special military operation led to the release of all hostages and the killing of the assailants earlier this week. An investigation based on Twitter's internal files has revealed that the social media platform helped the U.S. military amplify its online propaganda campaigns about its activities in West Asia. The probe says Twitter granted Pentagon-affiliated accounts more visibility, even allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. At the top of the campaign's agenda was spreading criticism of Iran and showing support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by U.S. Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after U.S. military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting U.S. military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the U.S. and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used faked pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022.
And that brings it into our international bulletin for this hour.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan power's policies in recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training.
The people who are creating corruption and damaging the streets are not all the same. Some of them are young people who take to the streets due to the influence of a program on the internet. Even so, all of them together are a very small fraction compared to the Iranian nation and compared to the faithful, devoted youth of Islamic Iran. However, some of them are not like this. The Ministry of Intelligence's recent statement clarified some of these matters to a large extent. But there is much more to this. The judiciary must determine their punishment in proportion to how much they have participated in the destruction and damaging the security of the streets.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another issue is that, from the very beginning, some officials said things or made statements out of sympathy. But without doing any research, without having done any research, some of them accuse the country's law enforcement. Some accuse the police, and some accuse the system as a whole. Each person did something in his or her own way. This is a separate issue. When they saw the truth, when they realized the effect of their statements, and when they saw the enemy's plan on the streets and in people's lives, they should have compensated for the things they had done. They should take a stand and openly state that they are against what has happened. They should make it clear that they are against the foreign enemy's schemes. The truth of the issue has been made clear. When you see US political elements comparing these events to the fall of the Berlin Wall, you should see what they are aiming at. You should realize that this is not about feeling sorry for the death of a young girl. You should have realized this. If you did not realize it, you need to realize it now. If you have realized this, then take a stand. This is another point.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
What you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The United States is a country too familiar with gun violence. Now a simple mass shooting doesn't even draw the attention of the public the way it used to. There has to be something special, like a horrific school shooting killing dozens of children or back-to-back shootings resulting in many casualties. Then you have lots of people, pundits, politicians speaking about it, trying to figure out the root cause. Some pin the blame on the guns themselves, and some say it's the people using the guns. Then the discussion phases out with almost no action until the next mass shooting occurs. And that's the vicious cycle going on for many years.
A nation under fire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Today, we're going to speak about an absurd increase in gun violence in America. The country has seen more than 600 mass shootings for three straight years. And every time there is a high-profile mass shooting or milestones like that, Americans are left asking themselves, what could be done to stop this? Yet, at the same time, they know that it is almost guaranteed the next year will be the same, if not worse. So what is behind the repeated mass shootings in the U.S. really? And to discuss this, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Dr. Wilmer Leone, columnist and political scientist, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Netfa Freeman, organizer at the Pan-African Community Action, also joining us from the U.S. Capitol. Stay tuned.
The new data on gun violence are out, and the picture does not look good. According to the nonprofit Gun Violence Archive, there have been 609 incidents of mass shootings in the United States this year in which four or more people other than the attacker were shot. This puts the U.S. on pace to reach around 675 by the end of the year. Last year, the country saw a staggering 690 mass shootings across the nation.
I watched as this community got shot up. A high school that was a mile from my own shooting. Like, seriously?
New research also shows that over 1 million people in the U.S. have been killed, both intentionally and accidentally, by a firearm in the past 30 years. That is roughly the number of people who have died from COVID-19 in the last couple of years.
Now, shocking numbers indeed. But to many, the element of shock has worn itself out because this has happened again and again. Americans have become overwhelmed by the scale of so much death and are convinced there is little they can do to change it. It's like the more they hear about shootings in public spaces, the less of an impression the news can make. Do you agree?
People in the U.S. are propagandized a lot, and they also, a lot of this sensationalized a lot. And some of the propaganda, and even just really what I would, and this is just an opinion and a theory, I guess, because I can only give a theory, is that there are a lot of Hollywood movies that talk about apocalyptic and dystopian futures and things like that. There's not anything really that impresses upon the people the need for cooperation and collectivism and doing things that would mitigate any type of emergencies, things like that, emergency preparedness. People are actually fed an individualism, something that tells them, hey, you got to prepare for all of the crazy people who will be coming and trying to get the little bit that you have.
Now, obviously, the pandemic and the surge to buy more guns during the early days of COVID-19 have played a key role in the surge of gun-related deaths in the last 3 years. But the question is, why should Americans rush to buy guns when a pandemic breaks out? And how much of a factor was the pandemic in the rise of gun violence in the past years?
Well, I don't think that we can really attribute this to the pandemic. America has been a violent nation since the Mayflower landed in Massachusetts. Look at the way that the early settlers dealt with the indigenous population, what we now know to call Indians. Look at how the Americans dealt with, well, enslaved the Africans and dealt with the Africans. America has been a violent nation since the inception of America.
When we go through the literature of gun violence and gun culture, there is so much talk about this, so many solutions presented by experts and politicians, and yet year after year, we see almost no action. What seems to be the problem?
Because you have the action to control gun violence is a very complicated thing when it comes to the United States. If we were to look at the legislature and the government of the United States that is dominated by the elites and this so-called, you know, struggle between the Republicans and the Democrats, but all of them are really beholden to big money interests. So sometimes they're really posturing when they really are beholden to big money. And so what the people really want, when people want certain things, they have to they can only pretend that they're going to do something with it. And then there's this deadlock in, you know, Congress or the House and those type of things. And then on the ground, compounded with that are the results what's produced, the conditions that are a result of capitalism and neoliberalism, poverty, frustration, despair, where people actually act out these things without any other recourse or ways of expressing themselves through violence. And then guns are the most ultimate form of violence in the United States. So because of this condition that I just mentioned about the frustration of things as a result of the economic system, that's the part that the powers that be are unwilling to address at all. So it becomes only confined to, well, control guns and have less guns, when it's something that's much more complicated than that.
A lot of the times, the discussions of mass shootings and the necessity to control gun violence end up in arguments on the Second Amendment, which guarantees a right of the people to keep and bear arms. However, the meaning of this clause cannot be understood apart from the purpose, the setting, and the objectives of the draftsman.
Because up until around the middle of the 1960s, the Supreme Court did not back the misinterpretation of the Second Amendment, saying that the Second Amendment, that there's a constitutionally protected right to keep and bear arms. That's not what the Second Amendment, says. If you understand English punctuation and grammar, that's not what the Second Amendment says. If you also understand dependent and independent clauses, a right to keep and bear arms has to do strictly with the need for a well-regulated militia to provide for the security of the free state. That's what the right in the Second Amendment is for. Now that we have a National Guard, we don't need a Second Amendment.
And now guns. They've always been a tool of power for Americans when the white settlers used them to subdue the Native Americans and keep the African Americans as slaves. America won the Second World War through gun power. Now, the United States has been constantly at war since then. That's why many refer to the problem of gun violence as gun culture. So can you really separate guns from American culture?
Mm-hmm. So there is what we would, I guess you call, a gun culture in the United States, and it stems out of, because of the United States as a settler colony, it's an extension of Western Europe and colonialism. In terms of its conquests around the world, did it by force. And there was discoveries like gunpowder, the use of gunpowder, and how they used it instead for what other people were using for. They used it instead for the types of, for purposes of domination.
There is rather a more insidious cause to the menace of mass shootings, and that is America's glorification of gun violence. American cultural products, movies, TV shows, and video games unapologetically glorify violence. According to one study, around 90% of American children have had some exposure to violent video games, and more than half prefer violent video games to non-violent ones.
The culture evolves around and is centered around violence. And we are a violent country. When you look at our television programs, violent television programs, when you listen to the music, violent music. So that has become, again, the one of the foundations or fundamental elements of American culture.
The conventional wisdom is that Republicans are pro-guns and Democrats are coming after your guns. So do you agree with this polarization? And if so, why do you think it's so?
Mm-hmm. I don't agree with the polarization. It's the oversimplification of what's happening in the United States, because when they say that, they're talking about the elite or the political class, those who control these parties, which is not the masses of the people, and those type of things that is a result of the economic conditions. And so the Democrats are posing as trying to be responsive to the people. They don't have answers for this. They all carry guns. Everybody carry. I mean, people carry guns, especially the elites who are trying to protect themselves. It doesn't matter whether they're Democrat or Republican. Let me refine that. Not that they themselves may be carrying guns, but their bodyguards carry guns. Put it that way, because they don't, you know, protect themselves. They have the police. They arm the police. I mean, you can't be against guns and then constantly funding the police. It's the Democrats, the bipartisan, lead this. And then around the world, their whole answers and solutions to everything is force of arms. And so, you know, you can't claim to be anti-gun, but you're pro-bombing and you're pro-high-power weapons, you're pro-weapons of mass, you know, all these kind of things. It's hypocrisy.
Polls show that the overwhelming majority of Americans support some restrictions on firearms, but Republicans' opposition to any new gun regulations is becoming stronger by the day, even in the face of gross mass shootings. So why has support for gun rights become a hallmark of the Republican Party?
Working at the behest of the gun lobby, Republicans always talk about, well, that's just the beginning. That puts us on the slippery slope that Democrats want to ban people's access to firearms. I've never heard a Democrat say that.
There is almost 400 million civilian-owned firearms in the United States. That is more than the population of the country. Americans make up 4% of the world's population, but own about 46% of the entire global stock of civilian firearms. Some surveys have shown that many people believe the country is moving toward another civil war. So is the situation like a tinderbox waiting to explode?
I mean, a civil war in the United States, I guess it's possible. I think it would be a misreading of the everything if we just thought of that. I would say, well, one, the statistic about how many guns there are to people.
The more guns that are around, the more people are going to use them. The more polarized the country is becoming, the greater the chances of a civil war breakout. There's also a greater chance of another major armed uprising like the one that happened on January 6th last year.
That too many people in this country don't really understand peaceful conflict resolution. Again, because we see so much violence on television, we hear so much violence in our music, that picking up the gun and what in many people has just become a knee-jerk reaction to where they think this is solving their problem because they're operating out of emotion instead of thinking through, how do I resolve this conflict for a win-win situation?
Now, a survey conducted by the Pew Research Center shows that white people have many more guns than black people do. First of all, why is this? And do you believe that gun control laws restrict black people more than they do whites?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this also has, you know, historical roots in some of the first law. The gun control laws were around making sure that indigenous people, Native Americans or American Indians, couldn't own a gun. Same thing with enslaved people. So it was about protecting the white settler colonial project, and that's carried on through the day. And even in fact, but there's contradictions there. So the gun laws and the amassing of guns in that industry was really leaned toward disproportionate terms favorable to white people. And even now, with us being more oppressed, like people of African descent, indigenous people, in terms of the laws can work against us in the sense that they put the gun control laws will have, you know, people that have records and all that. The mass incarceration in the United States we're represented disproportionately in the mass incarceration.
Now, maybe the question is not why black people have fewer guns. Some people believe that there is a morbid fear hardwired into white people that makes them buy guns in a frenzy fashion.
European Americans have this, what seems to be almost an innate fear that of retribution, that what they as a culture have done to people of color will eventually find its way back to their doorstep. And so they feel that in order to repel that enemy that will eventually make its way back to their doorstep based upon the way the inhumane and treatment that they have and the oppression that they have imposed upon others, those others are eventually coming and gunning for them.
There have been a lot of recommendations to curb gun violence. Those include reduce easy access to dangerous weapons, reduce firearms access to youth and individuals who are at risk of harming themselves or others, and hold the gun industry accountable, etc. But the question is, can gun legislations and prevention be truly effective in dealing with increasing levels of gun-related violence in America?
Gun legislation, what would the legislation be? It can't be. No, it can't, because to say that is to say that the only root, the only cause for violence is the existence of guns. But it doesn't say what is behind the act itself, what motivations, what emotional disturbances, what political dispositions and situation circumstances in prevailing in the country that are behind that, that are the root cause of it. Yes, access to guns could be one thing, but then we live in a settler, we're colonized. Some of us are colonized people, and that to act as if, you know, denial, because that was also that's what was happening before. Do you know, most people don't know this, during the 1960s and 1969, the National Rifle Association, the NRA, that's so infamous for protecting people's rights to guns, supported the Mulford Act in California. And they did that, which was a gun control legislation, probably the first gun control, but they supported that. A lot of people don't know it. And that Mulford Act was directly in response to the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. And the powers that be, because of this, our right by law, civil, quote-unquote, civil right by law in this country, changed that law. So we wouldn't have the right to organize ourselves against oppression. And we need, you know, so it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really, what the legislation is can be used to oppress people.
Yes, overall mass murders will go down with stricter gun control laws, and better mental health checks will probably reduce the number of massacres. But America's real mass murder problem is when those deaths are politicized and solutions are ignored along partisan lines. So can politicians really get it together and solve this? Well, in the short term, at least, it seems things are going to get much worse before they get better. And now, like every week, it's time to see what Abbas Montarim has prepared for us. Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. Today on the episode, we're just gonna take a look at some of the reasons why mass shootings in America keep on happening. So let's get into it. First, we gotta understand that violence is as American as apple pie. It's the very foundation of this settler colony. So when violence happens between America's citizens, it makes sense, as it's the very moral framework. It's the very moral framework in which this country was founded on. If we think about it, how can a nation that is perpetually at a state of war amongst the colonizers versus the colonized, and is also in a state of perpetual imperialist wars, not to be expected to have violence within the settler colony? This is why mass shootings happen, because realistically, it's part of the ethics of this so-called American settler colony. And if we look at the history of guns in America, it was also that these Europeans can steal the land from indigenous people and enslave Africans. All this was about the creation of the so-called American Empire.
Europeans with guns, they used them to steal Africans from Africa and enslave us. And then they were used in order to protect these newly founded European colonies in America and to protect the institution of slavery. And in the so-called United States Constitution, the Second Amendment, it legalized the right for the masses of European settlers to own guns in order to protect their property, which were enslaved Africans and stolen land. The Second Amendment of the Constitution, it says, quote, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. This allowed every settler to be armed to protect this power structure, whether they own slaves or not. And this is why there's millions upon millions of guns in the street today. This is the history. This is the historical development. And while the biggest mass shootings are usually referred to and reported by the media as happening in the span of the past few decades, the biggest mass shootings were happening to indigenous and African people at the hands of the colonizer. For example, on December 29th, 1890, U.S. troops killed over 300 Lakota people in the massacre at Wounded Knee. Yet when the media talks about mass shootings, or even popular discourse is about mass shootings, it never acknowledges, it rarely acknowledges how the USA and its military massacred over 300 people. And there's many massacres that we probably don't even know about. And while mass shootings are the newest forms of these mass killings, it's important to understand that the white settler European, they have been committing massacres against Africans and indigenous people throughout the history of this country. And they have used whatever weapon is at their disposal. This has literally created an American culture that is obsessed with violence, as violence is used to maintain the white settler colonial rule. And to sum it up, American culture and its propaganda is violence. You turn on the TV and it's imperialist movies glorifying the United States, bombing other countries. The music that's being pumped out by these corporations is glorifying violence. You read the American history books and it's also the glorification of violence. So it can be said that the average American citizen is propagandized to be violent. And this is why political education is so important. Because if we don't have an understanding of how our minds are being warped to think like the colonizer, we will be in a perpetual state of slavery, both mentally and physically. This is Power to the People.
Well, that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome. This is The Last Savior. You're listening to us from the IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Zainab. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we have been discussing about the certain signs of reappearance, and one of them was the uprising of Yamani. And we have a Dr. Karimi discussing about the Yamani, and in our last episode we discussed the place where this uprising would take place, and we confirmed from Shia sources all the narrations that the conclusion of all the narrations was that the uprising of Yamani would take place from the Yaman itself, because Yamani in itself means a man from Yaman. Well, Dr. Karim, in our previous episode we discussed all that through Shia sources. You also shared one of the hadiths from Sunni sources. I would want you to discuss more if we have some more Sunni sources quoting that he is a righteous man.
Sure. We said that although our dear listeners might consider it a very clear concept that Yamani is a righteous and virtuous person and he leads the people and guides the people, but because of the fact that there are some, doubts nowadays raised about the authenticity of such narrations, whether he is inviting the people toward Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, it's fairly necessary to share some narrations talking about the fact that he's a righteous man. He's not inviting people toward himself. He does not claim that he's an imam. He just invites the people toward Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. We shared some narrations in this regard from Shia sources and one from the Sunni sources. In another narration quoted in Al-Fitan, page 67, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, يَكُونُ بَعْدَ الْجَبَابِرَ رَجُلٌ مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي. After a group of oppressive rulers, a man from my progeny will come. It seems that, this narration is referring for sure to Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. يَمْلَأُ الْأَرْضَ عَدْلًا. He will fill the earth with justice. ثُمَّ الْقَحْتَانِ بَعْدَهُ. Then Qahtani will come after him. We said that one of the titles given to Yamani in Sunni sources is
Qahtani as well.
وَالَّذِي بَعَثَنِي بِالْحَقِّ مَا هُوَ دُونَهُ. Of course, we are not, confirming all the points mentioned in this narration. This is from one of the Sunni sources. The point that we would like to get from this narration is that he is a virtuous man.
Okay.
According to this narration, the Holy Prophet says that I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that the status of Yamani is not that much lower than that of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. The other narration, again from Al-Fitan, page 245, we are quoting from Sunni sources. He says that يَكُونَ بَعْدَ الْمَهْدِ خَلِيفَةٌ مِنْ أَهْلِ يَمَنْ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْيَمَنْ مِنْ قَحْطَانِ. After Mahdi, there would be a successor from the people of Yemen, from Qahtan.
Okay.
يَعْمَلُ بَعْمَلِهِ. He will act like Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So these narrations also refer to the fact that he is
a righteous person. The flag bearer.
Of course, some of the details
guidance.
We may not agree. For example, we believe that he will come before the uprising of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. These two narrations refer that to the
here
point
we
that
are referring to the point that is he a righteous person or not? Yeah.
But they said that he will come after Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, but this is against the narrations in Shia sources.
All right, that contradicts with the narrations from Shia sources. Dr. Karimi will continue the discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
I can feel your eyes. Like the sun shining behind the clouds, I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. 6,000-year-old pain.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Dr. Karimi, and we are discussing about Yamani. Well, Dr. Karimi, you discussed about the police office uprising. You discussed about the flag bearer, that he would be the flag bearer of guidance. And you are proving the point through Shia sources and as well as Sunni sources. Only the fact that we contradict with the Sunni narrations on the point that he is not going to come after Imam, he's going to come before Imam. Well, no more on that. We came to the conclusion that he is a righteous person, both for both the sources, be that Sunni source or be that Shia sources. Oh, the most important question that rises over here is that, do people need to go to help Yamani in case he's in need? Like, for example, people living in any other part of the world and Yamani living in Yemen needs some kind of help of a person who can make himself reach there. Is it obligatory or is it necessary, or what is the duty of that person?
This is, I believe, one of the most important questions related to the personality of Yamani. So for sure, we prove that he's a very righteous person, inviting the people toward the guidance. He is one of the signs of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, according to some, one of the definite signs, and according to some, one of the uncertain signs. But the point is that his uprising is approved by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Yeah.
Now, the question is that, and this is very important, hopefully we'll see Yamani in our time.
Yeah.
Is it necessary for all the Muslims, all the Shia, all around the world, just to go to, let's say, Yemen to help Yamani? Because he will have some struggles and fights, especially with Sufyani, according to the narrations. Again, our dear listeners might think that naturally we need to do that because he's a virtuous person, he's fighting Sufyani, the enemy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But the point is that there are some researchers, especially by the contemporary Shia scholars on this regard, and the reason which makes it more important is that some of the people in our time, they have falsely claimed that they are the promised Yamani.
Yeah.
Like that person from Basra, from Iraq. He claims that I'm the promised Yamani, and he asks all the people to go and help him.
All right.
So now the question is that, let's imagine that he is the promised Yamani. Is it necessary for me living in Europe, in the United States, in Australia, anywhere in this world, to go and to help this person from Yemen who claims to be the promised Yamani? Although he's not. But imagine that he is.
All right.
Is it necessary for
us
to go?
What is my duty right now?
Exactly. So there is one narration in this regard according to which people need to go and help Yamani.
All right.
We have only one narration in this regard. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, وَإِذَا خَرَجَ الْيَمَانِ فَانْهَضْ إِلَيْهِ. When you see the uprising of Yamani, then go to him. فَإِنَّ رَايَتُهُ رَايَةُ هُدَى. Because of the fact that his flag is the flag of guidance. وَلَا يَحِلُّ لِمُسْلِمٍ أَن يَلْتَوِيَ عَلَيْهِ. And it's not permitted for any Muslim to
stand against him,
exactly.
All right.
فَمَنْ فَعَلَ ذَلَكَ فَهُوَ مِنْ أَهْلِ النَّارِ. If you stand against him, you would be one of the inmates of fire, because he invites the people toward the truth and toward the straight path. Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 262, chapter 14, hadith number 13. Now, we have this narration quoted from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, and it seems that we cannot find any other authentic narrations to have asked the Shia to go and help Yamani.
What could be concluded about the duty of believers? I'll ask you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Last